Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
If this government is formed, the key word will be responsibility.
The scramble to replace Benjamin Netanyahu after 12 years in power. Bibi biographer Anshul Pfeffer breaks down what's at stake. Then, support for tennis star Naomi Osaka continues to pour in. I'll discuss her stand on mental health with Tennis Hall of Famer Pam Shriver and sports journalist Kavita Davidson. Plus, Walter Isaacson speaks to lifelong Republican and former Congressman Mickey Edwards about the party he calls a cult. And
1971, I don't think the music was a reflection of the times as much as the music also caused the times.
It was the year that gave us hit albums like Imagine and What's Going On. The co-director of the new docuseries 1971, The Year That Music Changed Everything, tells me about that transformative time.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Ladriga in New York, sitting in for Christian Amanpour. Benjamin Netanyahu's run as the longest-serving Israeli prime minister may well be coming to an end. A coalition of opposition parties is working to form a new government. Naftali Bennett, leader of the right-wing party Yamina, has joined forces with centrist leader Yair Lapid. It's being seen as the most serious challenge to Netanyahu's leadership to date. He's calling the coalition a, quote, danger to the security of Israel. Now, Bennett and Lapid's efforts to pull together a number of different parties comes after no clear majority was reached in the latest election back in March. Israelis have now gone to the polls four times in just the last 2 years. So what could a change in leadership mean for the country? Anshul Pfeffer is a columnist for Haaretz. He also wrote the biography Bibi, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu. And he's joining me now from Jerusalem. Great to have you on. I want to start to get the latest on what the latest state of play is right now. We can never rule Bibi out until we have a definitive answer. But things have really come down to the wire, Anshul.
Good evening, Bianca from Jerusalem. Yes. As we speak, the leaders of the eight parties who are committed to join this coalition, which will form a government to replace Netanyahu, are meeting in a hotel near Tel Aviv to basically finalize the coalition agreements. They have another 4 hours before the deadline expires, and they seem very close to signing the agreements. Five of the parties have already agreed. Three parties are left. There are a few outstanding issues, but they'll probably overcome those in the next 2 or 3 hours. But as you said, it's not over yet. Once the coalition has signed the agreements, they have to actually swear in the new government. To do that, they have to pass a confidence vote in the Knesset. That will take place sometime probably next week. And Netanyahu is doing everything he can to pressure some of the coalition's members into somehow dropping out and to deny the coalition of a majority.
And this coalition is made up of eight different parties of completely different political spectrums. Can you give us a sense of what they have in common other than wanting to oust Bibi Netanyahu?
Well, that really is their unifying purpose. They're so different. They're right-wing, centrist, left-wing, Arab, Islamist, conservative parties. They really have very, very little in common, except this desire not just to replace Netanyahu, but to restore some kind of stability, some kind of equilibrium to Israeli politics. And they also will talk about the need to try and restore some kind of sense of unity to Israeli society that they feel that Netanyahu has damaged, has created all these divisions, certainly exacerbated the divisions in Israeli society. And that will be the coalition's rhetoric. This will be a unifying government. They're even calling it a healing government. That may be a step too far, but that's the kind of words they're using.
Right. And it's hard to imagine a healing government or a viable longer term government when in the best case scenario, the most that all of these parties can agree on is agreeing to disagree on so many of these issues. Do you see this as a viable coalition?
Well, as we said, the unifying purpose of this coalition is to replace Netanyahu. But Netanyahu, even if he is forced to leave office in a week or so, will not be going away. He'll remain the leader of the opposition. He'll continue to rally his base and the parties which supported him, which will now be, if this happens, they'll be in the opposition. And it won't be an easy period for the government. It won't be an easy period for Israeli society. But the fact that Netanyahu will be trying to break them up, to get back into office, I think that will continue their sense of purpose in sticking together. And we may see this government lasting more than most people expect.
So Bibi's presence alone, just the fact that he would still remain in the Knesset and leader of a party there, could give them viability to move forward. But anyone who's been covering and following Israeli politics over the last few months, you know, you can't blame them for having whiplash, because it seems prior to the latest rise in violence between the Israelis and Gaza, you saw the potential for a coalition to oust Bibi as well, a different type of coalition. But his political career seemed to be hanging by a thread. Then all of a sudden you had the violence and he seemed to be secure in his leadership. And here we are again. Can you sort of walk us through what's transpired here?
Well, let's go back even further than that. Let's go back just over a year ago, when it also seemed that there may be a coalition to remove Netanyahu. And then along came the coronavirus pandemic. And this sense of national emergency was what saved Netanyahu and allowed him to bring in the leader of the coalition, Benny Gantz, in what was supposed to be an emergency government. It didn't last very long. But these crises are happening in this region and in Israel all the time. It's not just when there's a global pandemic. So this is a challenge for the new government if it is actually sworn in. But it also creates for them opportunities to show that politics can be done differently in Israel. It doesn't necessarily have to be the politics of divide and rule, the politics of what Netanyahu has done, of playing off communities, inciting Israeli and Jewish communities against each other. There is a different way of doing politics. Israeli politics hasn't always been just about ganging up on each other and being either for or against Netanyahu. And I know from speaking to some of the leaders of these parties that they want to prove that politics can be done differently and that they can overcome some major policy disagreements in the interest of proving that there is a different way of doing things.
So is Naftali Bennett the man who can bring that change and the unity and the healing to the country? Because say what you will, so much of the world associates Israeli leadership now with Benjamin Netanyahu, for better or worse. What do we know about Naftali Bennett, and what does he bring to the table?
Well, Naftali Bennett was, at least at the beginning of his political career, groomed by Netanyahu. He came in the mid-30s into politics after making a fortune in high tech, and he basically volunteered to serve as Netanyahu's chief of staff at the time in 2006, that they fell out pretty quickly. And Bennett doesn't really bring any political power. He brings the last few seats necessary for there to be a coalition. And he also sort of brings this idea that the right wing can sit with the center and the left, which is why Yair Lapid, who is the real architect of the coalition and the leader of the biggest party in the coalition, is going to give Bennett the first 2 years of the term to prove that right-wingers can sit with the rest of the political wings in Israel and have a government together. Now, Bennett will not have much political power of his own. He's a leader of a small party. He'll be prime minister, but he'll have to prove that he can work with all his different partners to keep this government together. And in some ways, I think that's a good development for Israeli politics, because instead of having this all-powerful mega statesman leader like Netanyahu, who has been identified with the role of prime minister for so long, the prime minister's role or position will be, I think, reduced to its proper proportions. Israel is not a presidential system of government. It's a parliamentary system. The prime minister is supposed to be the first among equals. He's not supposed to be this massive character like Netanyahu has been for so long. And I think it'll be a good experience for Israel to have a prime minister who needs to work in harmony with his partners rather than dominate them.
So let's say this goes forward and we do have a government where Naftali Bennett and then Yair Lapid share power, switching after 2 years. What would that look like? Because we know Naftali Bennett is far right, and we know that Yair Lapid is left of center. Why isn't Yair Lapid the one who is going to be taking over if, in fact, this does go through the first 2 years, if his party has, in fact, more seats and it's more powerful?
Well, Yair Lapid made a strategic decision that the most important thing was to replace Netanyahu and put a new government in place of his government. And he put his own personal ambitions and his own party's precedence, he put that aside. And for him, the priority was just to get a government. He said from the beginning, I don't necessarily have to be the prime minister of this government. And I think that in itself is also a very, very counterintuitive move to anything we've seen in the Netanyahu era. It's all been about being the top dog, you know, taking power. Lapid said, for me, it's much more important the process rather than that I should be the number one personality. So that, I think, is a very, very positive move by Lapid. And so far, it seems to be working. By prioritizing the government and not his own position, he has actually brought this coalition into being. We're still not quite there yet, but we're the closest we've ever been to replacing Netanyahu. And he's done that by putting his ego aside. Now, obviously, Lapid will be the most powerful person in this government, at least next to Naftali Bennett. But by deferring his own ambitions, I think he's allowed this process to go ahead.
How would a change in government impact the impasse now between Israelis and Hamas, in particular, this fragile ceasefire that's now in its second week? What does that signify in terms of where the situation is right now, in terms of Egyptians who are taking part in these negotiations of this ceasefire? Is there any difference at all that this new leadership would bring to the table?
Well, you've identified the most vulnerable issue for this government, because this government is combined from leaders who can't agree on Israel's policy vis-a-vis the Palestinians and what should be done in Gaza. And if the issue of Gaza flares up again, certainly early in this government's term, it'll be very difficult for them to come out with some kind of policy. But let's not forget that for the last 12 years, ever since Netanyahu returned to power in 2009, there has been no Israeli policy in Gaza. It's just been stick to the status quo, stick to the blockade, which began in 2007, the Israeli-Egyptian blockade on Gaza ever since Hamas took over Gaza in 2007 in the bloody coup. That's been Netanyahu's policy throughout. He has not changed the policy that was already there when he came into government. And I think that this new government, if it is indeed sworn in, will try to stick to that, at least for the time being, because they can't, I think, come up with a new policy. But if they are challenged, if Hamas renews the rocket firings, or if the Egyptians somehow manage to reach some kind of a draft agreement between Israel and Hamas, then this government will have to take a position and it'll be tested. That will be really the moment where we'll see if this government is viable.
I was struck by listening to some of the comments out of Bibi Netanyahu over the past couple of days as things have become more tense and his political career has become, more of a crisis for him, or I guess the biggest crisis he's faced in years. One of the things he said is, what is Washington going to think? How is the U.S. going to react to this change in government, as if, you know, the two, especially the current administration, is attached at the hip with Bibi Netanyahu. But it does raise the question of what impact would a change in government have on the U.S.-Israeli policies? And does Bennett have, if any, sort of relationships in Washington and within the Biden administration?
Well, certainly Bennett has nowhere near the kind of relationships and connections and experience Netanyahu has had. Netanyahu has been in Israeli political life for 34 years. And before that, he was an Israeli diplomat in Washington and in New York. So there's no way anybody can compete with Netanyahu's wealth of connections and relationships in the U.S. But I think it's also pretty clear that as far as the Biden administration is concerned, they'd be quite happy to be dealing with someone else. I mean, Joe Biden is a very polite and very reserved person. He hasn't shown any of his exasperation with Netanyahu's show, but we know that he would be quite happy for a fresh set of interlocutors in the Israeli government. And once this government is sworn in, Yair Lapid will be the foreign minister for the first year. So for all purposes, he'll be one of Israel's main spokespeople and faces in the U.S. And I think that they'll want to work both with Bennett and with Lapid. And I think that, quite frankly, they'll be happy to take a break from Netanyahu. And Bennett himself is a son of American parents. He's lived in the U.S. He can deal with it.
Yeah, he's very familiar with the U.S. But let's end on a note of where we began, and that is never say never. And you have seen many political lives for Bibi Netanyahu. You, of course, have written a book on him. He has been in control of his narrative and his family's narrative throughout his political career. This may be the first time that he's not in control. But as you said, he is not going anywhere, even if, in fact, a new government is formed. How is this impacting him personally, do you think?
Well, certainly he's very worried. I wouldn't say he's desperate, but he's not far from that. We saw in his statement on Sunday night when he spoke about this new government being a threat to Israel's security and even comparing this new government to the Assad regime in Syria and to the Iranian leadership, we saw him almost losing control. And, you know, he's been for so long used to ruling Israel, to having all this power at his disposal. He has been in the past, at least twice, leader of the opposition, right. But I don't think he's prepared at the age of 71 to go back to that. He'll have to, but he really is on the brink himself, and he's pulling out all the stops to try and
yes,
prevent
this.
Yes, he is.
He has legal challenges ahead of him, but of course there's no term limits in Israel again. So even if he's out this time, who knows what will happen in the next few years. Anshul Pfeffer, always great to have you on and hear your perspective. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diana.
Well, now the leaders of all four tennis Grand Slams have given their support to Naomi Osaka after the world's number two player withdrew from the French Open. She pulled out on Monday following her refusal to speak to the media in order to, quote, protect her mental health. The tennis star has revealed that she's been suffering with bouts of depression since winning the 2018 U.S. Open. Fellow athletes are speaking out in support of her decision. Take a listen to what Novak Djokovic said.
This was... I must say, very bold decision from her side, but she knows how she feels best. And if she needs to take time and reflect and just recharge, and you know, that's what she needed to do. And I respect it fully, and I hope that she'll come back stronger.
With me now to discuss the important story is Pam Shriver, former pro player and a Hall of Famer. Also joining us is journalist Kavita Davidson. Welcome, both of you. Pam, let me get to you first, because you have been on tour many, many years. You have taken part in these press conferences. Can you give us a sense of the pressure that these players feel when they come and face these journalists and these cameras?
Well, I really think it depends on the player and the personality and maybe what's happened in the match. Generally, in my years of playing, I didn't struggle with it, but I'm much more of an extrovert, and I was always very comfortable in that arena. But I do think that some players like Naomi Osaka, who are shy and introverted, and during this time of the pandemic where it's all been virtual and you can't actually see the media, people asking questions in person, you sort of lose some of the personal touch of walking into a press conference and maybe having a little bit of banter. So it's kind of like students in school. Not all of them on Zoom school are comfortable. In the case of Naomi Osaka, the growing anxiety was a bit much for her.
And your reaction to how the officials initially responded there to her refusing to participate, because it seemed as if they were angry and they exposed that. I mean, they talked about other athletes. They even tweeted that the other athletes understand the assignment. Perhaps she doesn't. They later retracted that tweet and deleted it. But there was an initial cold response to that. And it was not until she disclosed her own struggles and bouts with depression that I think that the conversation shifted. How important, Pam, is it in your opinion to have these conversations right now?
Well, I think it's very important to have them. I do think that Naomi's original post in the middle of qualifying week of Roland Garros, the French Open, caught everybody by surprise. All these tournaments, just like the players, they're stretched right now. Their bandwidth, they have very little extra bandwidth given trying to put these international sporting events on during a global pandemic. So I think the French Federation were on their heels. I did not think they responded well. I think they needed to really take their time and assess and try and get through to some communication, even if it took some days, and don't sort of fuel the fire with some public statements. I especially didn't like Sunday's statements by the four majors that included the threats of a possible default with a code of conduct coming into play. That's really what pushed Naomi into a corner. I thought that statement was very unfortunate.
Kavitha, when we hear now from Naomi that she'd been struggling with bouts of depression and mentally since that 2018 U.S. Open victory over Serena Williams, I can't help but go back and look at images of that day, how the crowds were booing, how she was apologizing, quite frankly, when she was saying that in giving that interview that she knows the crowd wanted things to go differently. How should we reflect back to those images of her hiding, you know, underneath her visor and crying, and think about what this has done to her emotionally and mentally?
Well, I mean, I think that it's one of those things where, like Pam said, we have to take this as an individual basis thing. Naomi Osaka is a human being, and it is quite striking to go back and look at some of those images. But you can also just see that she's an introverted person by seeing how she's answered questions in the past. Mm-hmm. I also think it's really important to point out that Naomi Osaka did answer questions on the court after winning her first round match at Roland Garros. So she wasn't refusing to do all media. And I think that that's kind of getting lost in some of this conversation.
And so go into that, because, you know, you have these corporations and these entities saying that this is part of the deal, that they know what they sign up for, that it's not only the play, but it's obviously talking to the press afterwards. There's a lot of money involved in these sports and these tournaments. Is there a point to be made that this is sort of an athlete's obligation, and if they can't fulfill it, then they will be fined? Or should we look at things differently now?
I mean, I think that we have to look at this with just a little bit of empathy. But Naomi Osaka knew that she was going to get fined because she does have this obligation, and she signed up for it. And she was willing to be fined. She actually said in her initial statement that she hopes the fine would be given to a mental health charity. I think that it was really the overreaction of the four slams to threaten default and to threaten, forcing her out of the tournament that took this to a whole other level. And we've had this conversation before about whether athletes owe us their time. As a journalist, access is all that we have to go on, and it's so important to what we do. But at the same time, if somebody is telling you that they're going to be in distress from having to answer some questions, then I think we really do need to listen to that.
And this is a subject that obviously we haven't addressed nearly enough, and other athletes and tennis stars are weighing in. Venus Williams was asked about how she feels given Naomi's situation and what she's going through and her perspective. I think we have audio. Let's listen to what she said.
For me personally, how I deal with it was that I know every single person asking me a question can't play as well as I can and never will. So no matter what you say or what you write, you'll never light a candle to me. So that's how I deal with it. But each person deals with it differently.
Pam, do you identify with how Williams sees this and approaches these questions, or is this sort of an each player has their own way of dealing with the pressure?
Well, let's face it, Venus and Serena have been getting questions since the mid-90s when they were just teenagers, and now Venus is 40 and Serena is chasing the all-time mark. So they're true professionals. Certainly Venus has walked out once or twice after matches. She's never made an announcement before a tournament. Serena's had some difficult moments, obviously, especially at U.S. Open in the media conference room. But in the end, they accept it as part of the job. And I like the way Venus kind of turns it into, like, she knows she's the tennis expert. And they're just asking questions to get my expertise about my match. I thought that was a pretty good way of looking at it.
Kavitha, are female players in particular subjected to a different line of questioning more so than male athletes?
I think so. And it's really unfortunate, because I really truly believe that me and most of my colleagues just want to do the best job that we can. But if you've ever sat in on any of these post-match press conferences, you've heard some pretty offensive questions being asked, particularly of women players and particularly of women of color. You know, you talk about when Pam talked about how seasoned pros Venus and Serena are, which is absolutely true. If you were also growing up as a player like Naomi Osaka, watching the kinds of questioning that Venus and Serena have had to endure over the last couple of years, the last couple of decades, I think that you might be wary about the media as well.
And what do you say to that, Pam? Because I think that there's been this perception that, A, this is part of their job. They signed up for this. They make endorsement deals. They make a lot of money. We shouldn't be so sympathetic, given that, you know, all that they're asking for is to answer a few questions from the media. Given that now so many athletes are speaking out about what a challenge this is for them and their emotional, the toll that it's taking on them emotionally, should we, as fans, should we, as part of the media, approach things differently?
Well, in the case of a tennis media conference, especially at a major, I mean, the lion's share of the journalists asking questions are tennis beat writers, or they write about sports all the time. But sometimes you get into a country like, say, Wimbledon in the UK, you can get some tabloid journalism, and you can get some questions that are really, you can tell, they're not coming from a sports writer or a tennis writer. They're sort of in a different realm. And I think sometimes those questions, those surprise questions, can really make some players really anxious. But I think that's why you have media training. That's why most of the top players, you know, not only do they have their coach and their physio, and but they also have people to help them with the media. You know, and I think Naomi, it's been asked before whether or not she should get some media training, but it was like, no, let's just have Naomi Osaka as her authentic self. But I think this proves that maybe she could use a little bit of media training and how to bridge, if she gets a question she doesn't like, how to bridge to something positive, a message that she wants to get across, like she did 10 months ago at the U.S. Open so effectively.
Pam, Chris Evert was asked about this last night with Chris Cuomo on CNN, and I found her answer to be really interesting. Take a listen.
There are times in my life when I lost a final to Virginia Wade and at Wimbledon, and I went into my hotel room and didn't leave my hotel room for 3 days and just ate and just was in my robe and was totally depressed. There is a time in 1976 when I won Wimbledon and I went back to a hotel room and I laid down on the ground. I couldn't get up because I felt so lonely and so isolated. I took 4 months off in the middle of my career because I was burned out.
You know, these are things that we haven't heard much about from athletes. We know when they take time off because they may have some aches and injuries, sports injuries to their bodies, right? But for their mental state and mental injuries, we don't talk nearly enough about that, should we? Should depression and bouts with struggles with depression be right up there with a hamstring pull?
Absolutely. I think that's going to be one of the positive silver linings coming out of this debacle, is that mental health and some of the struggles, whether it's depression, anxiety, or OCD, you know, any of the conditions that can come forward and be triggered and be made worse, that the athlete, that the teams around the athletes, the WTA Tour, the majors, we have to look at that just as you say. It's not that different from a physical injury, and it takes time to recover. And you can't race back into the arena until you're healthy again. So it's going to be interesting to see when Osaka decides that she's healthy again and ready to play.
What is your message, Pam, to Naomi?
Oh, my message is part of the wording she did in her statement the other day when she withdrew, which is to really understand self-care. And in a complicated time during a global pandemic where her home country is about to host the Olympic Games and she's the highest paid female athlete, I mean, she really needs to take care of not just her physical self, but all of herself, and have a team around her that helps that self-care take place.
Kavita, do you see this as a game-changing moment, seeing as so many of her sponsors have come out in full support of her? We've seen more athletes come out in support of her as well. Is this a game-changing moment in women's tennis?
I do think so. And I think that this is also a continuation of a conversation that we've been having, that athletes have been having for at least a year now, where they're more comfortable talking about their own struggles with mental health. And, you know, there are all of these notions about playing through pain, playing through physical pain, without acknowledging the emotional and mental pain so many of these athletes are going through. And especially in tennis, which is such an isolating individual sport, I really do think that this is a conversation that Naomi Osaka has started that we're going to be having for a very long time.
Kavita Davidson from The Athletic, thank you so much. Pam Shriver, thank you as well. This was a really important conversation. We appreciate it. Well, now we're going to be turning to U.S. politics and the changing face of the GOP. Lifelong Republican and former Congressman Mickey Edwards walked away from his party earlier this year, saying that it had become less of a party and more of a cult. Here he is speaking to our Walter Isaacson about whether they're fit to run the highest office in America and the myth that the election was stolen.
Thank you, Bianna. And Mickey Edwards, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Walter. Good to see you.
So many of what were once your fellow Republicans in Congress voted not to look at the January 6th insurrection and even said that they weren't willing to certify Trump's vote. Do you think they really believe that the election was fraudulent?
Well, I think some of them do, but I think a lot more, and I think their voters do, because the voters have been, you know, they watch the newscasts that they watch, and they listen to the president. But I think a lot of the members of Congress are just terrified of being attacked in primaries, you know, that Trump endorses somebody to run against them in their party primary, and they lose. And I think fear, to a large extent, Walter, I think it's cowardice. They will do anything to hold on to these precious offices they hold.
And explain to me, Leader McConnell or Kevin McCarthy in the Congress, what is motivating them, do you think?
Part of it is, as you know, I've been critical of the party process, the whole party system for a long time, but it's about power. They see that the House and the Senate are both very much in play. The Democrats barely won the two houses. They barely won the presidency, although it was pretty good size, but Trump got a lot of votes. And I think they see that they have to do what they're doing now to energize their base and win back control in 2 years, control of Congress in 2 years. I think that's the only thing that's motivating them. They don't care about the policies. They care about how they're going to regain control.
You say they're afraid of being primaried. Is there some structural reform we could do to the primary and party system that would make the country be balanced once again?
Well, sure. You look to California, Washington State. This is something I've advocated for a long time, is you remove the party process from the election process. And you just have open primaries. Anybody of whatever party can run. That's how Kamala Harris got elected to the Senate in California. It was Democrats and Republicans all on one ticket rather than a party primary. And then the top two people run against each other. That's a much better system. It takes away the ability of the extremes in either party to dictate, because under the rules, if you don't win your party's nomination now in most states, you can't run. You know, the voters don't get a chance to consider you. So, yes, we need structural changes in the system.
You know, Liz Cheney, what do you think about her ouster from the Republican leadership?
You know, it's funny, when they ousted her, they sort of made her a hero because she was the conference chair. Most people who follow politics, I don't know, Walter, if you could name who was the conference chair before she was.
But you were the conference chair once when you were an Oklahoma congressman. I know that.
I was chairman of the policy committee, but it was, people don't know who that is. And they elevated her prestige quite a bit by getting rid of her. But it does say something. That there's not tolerance for dissent, that as in any cult, what happens now in this case, it was in the House, you toe the line, you're part of our team. You're not a representative from Wyoming. You're not an individual person who took an oath of office as a member of Congress. You are part of our team, and you're expected to be with our team, stick with our team, vote with our team. And if you don't do that, we're going to get rid of you. And that's what happened to her. And I think they made her stronger by doing it.
You've used the word cult to describe the Republican Party. That's a pretty strong word. Why do you think it's a cult?
You know, the definition of a cult, you think of Jonestown, right? You think of Ruby Ridge. It's systems where you have a strong leader who takes a position and says, this is what we're doing. And everybody just salutes and says, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. And does it. They stick together with whatever rules they've adopted. Rather, it does away with free thinking. It does away with individual people making individual decisions on the merits of the questions that are before them. And I think that's pretty much the definition of a cult, certainly a definition of what the Republican Party is now.
Do you think QAnon is a cult in that it's infected the Republican Party?
I don't know enough about QAnon, to some extent it's there are so many different little groups that have formed around or within the Trump orbit, just spew nonsense. It's not just that what there's lies, but it's nonsense, just ridiculous theories. And for whatever reason, Eric Hoffer wrote this great book, The True Believer, where people want to be part of something bigger and transcendent beyond themselves. And Eric Fromm wrote his book, Escape from Freedom, about how people want a leader, somebody to follow. And I think a lot of that's at play in the country right now. There are a lot of people who just want to latch on to something that they can feel that they have a guide, they have something that they can follow. We need a counter narrative. We need to recreate a sense of support and belief in democracy, as opposed to these weird ideas that come out of these sects.
The most extreme case of this in the past week has been talk of reinstatement, as Trump himself may have even said that he wants to be reinstated in August, or even a military coup. This seems so wacky and so fringe that some people would just dismiss it. Is it actually dangerous, this talk?
Yes. And the reason is, a lot of the things, Walter, that you and I both would have dismissed as just nutty, and, don't even pay any attention, don't write an op-ed about it. This is some fringe, crazy idea. Now those things are taking root and people are doing it. They're buying into it. Why that is, I don't know. That's way beyond my pay grade to try to figure out what it is. There are legitimate grievances. There are a lot of places in this country that got left out of economic expansion. A lot of people are bothered by the income gap between the top wealth, the wealthy people, and the working class. There are a lot of legitimate grievances, but that doesn't excuse seizing onto these crazy theories in order to deal with it. So we have to do both. We have to address the grievances, which so many of them are legitimate. And at the same time, we have to rebuild belief in democracy and the reasons why ever since the Enlightenment, we've been saying that we should be able as a free people to govern ourselves responsibly and create government that works.
Let me ask you a philosophical question now. Do you think that the Republican Party, as it's now constituted, still has a valid role to play in a constitutional democracy?
Walter, and I get asked that sometimes in terms of what's the future of the Republican Party? Can it exist? It's complicated because there's two sides to this. I don't any longer think the Republican Party, as it is currently, has any kind of a valid role to play in a constitutional democracy because it doesn't accept the norms of a constitutional democracy. But that said, that doesn't mean the Republican Party is doomed. A large part of what the party does in its campaigns is run against the left, and there's a resonance to that. So I think it's quite possible that the Republican Party can both be outside the norms of what a constitutional democracy requires and still win elections, still win the presidency, still win control of Congress. I think that's a real possibility.
Would that be dangerous to our constitutional democracy?
I think it'd be terribly dangerous. The Republican Party today has taken on a lot of the trappings of an authoritarian state. They have a strong leader who dictates and doesn't tolerate dissent. who lies about election results, who attacks the practice of the free press, who wants to have judges who are going to, well, obviously both parties seem to want judges who are just going to do what they want them to do. But I think that if Republicans were to take control of the House, Senate, and the presidency, I think our whole constitutional democracy would be in serious danger.
What do you think of the efforts in Georgia, Texas, and many other Republican legislatures to try to tamp down the votes, and in particular, African-American votes?
You know, we are, people think we're a pure democracy. We're not. We're a constitutional republic. But we elect in a democratic system the people who are going to make the laws that we live under, whether we go to war, what our taxes are going to be, everything else. And tamping down the vote, whether it's of African Americans or whites, whatever it is, tamping down the vote in a democracy is just anti-democratic and anti-American. It's against everything that we have stood for as a nation, you know, since our founding. As long as you have the basic rules, you know, make sure that you can't vote in an election, for example, you can vote in New Orleans, but you can't vote in Baton Rouge because you don't live in Baton Rouge. As long as we have those kind of protections in place, we need to do everything we can to allow people to vote, not make it harder for them, but make it easier.
How much of a problem is gerrymandering, and how can it be fixed?
Well, you know, it's been a big problem for a long time. The Democrats did this in California in the 1970s with great effect. Gerrymandering means essentially the elected officials get to choose who their voters are. And they draw the districts so that they increase their chances of winning and make sure that the other side doesn't have a chance. We, under the Constitution, which requires that every elected representative and senator must be an actual inhabitant of the state from which they're elected, envisions that you have a representative kind of a government. And when you start drawing lines in really weird, crazy ways, just to freeze people out of voting in that election, it goes against everything that our constitutional system was designed to protect.
There seems to be a contradiction or paradox where the parties are getting more and more hard line and hardcore, each of them. And yet a lot of people seem to be fleeing the traditional two parties, becoming independents. Do you think there could ever be a independent movement in America?
Oh, I think so. There are a lot of people working on these things right now. I'm spending a lot of time on it. Our founders did not want political parties. George Washington said, don't create political parties. Our original parties were nothing like the parties now. They were basically shifting coalitions, except on a few issues. I think that the current system in which we allow parties to control both the governing process and the election process is not only obsolete, but I'll bet you in 20 years it'll be gone, that we will move much more in the direction of what California has done, Washington has done. And we will get rid of this system where parties are able to control every step of the process.
Explain to me what you mean by parties controlling the election system. How do you reduce the influence of the Democratic and Republican parties in choosing who gets to run?
Well, there's a couple of ways. One of them is if you have an open primary where everybody can run in the same place. So that way you eliminate the party activists from being able to control the outcome. That's one way. You also do it by getting rid of sore loser laws. So in almost every state, people aren't familiar with that term, in almost every state, there is a law on the books that if you run in a primary of your party and you don't win, you can't be on the ballot in November, which means you might be much more popular in the state at large among all the voters. But if the people, the activists, the smaller number who vote in a primary weren't pleased with you, then you're off the ballot. You're through. You can't run. You can get rid of sore loser laws, which is part of what California and Washington did. And that would be a big step forward.
Well, sore loser laws, gerrymandering, closed primaries, all of those are done by both the Democrats and the Republicans because it protects the party apparatus in each state. Right. So how do you break that?
Well, you know, a lot of states, Walter, have ability to have an initiative petition or a referendum that you can use. And the voter, in fact, in California and Washington, that's what happened. The voters went around the parties. They went around the legislative process. They took the issue directly to the people. And they change their systems. You can do that in a number of states. And others, you just have to, you know, work on the legislators and try. You have to have build a grassroots movement to break the hold of the political parties over our political governing systems.
As a longtime Oklahoma conservative, an American conservative, how do you assess the beginning of Joe Biden's term as president?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Walter. I love the things he is saying. I think Joe Biden is a very good man with great values. I think that he's in a box. Number one, I think he knows that there's a chance that Republicans are going to be able to take control in 4 years and maybe of the House and Senate before that. He's got a short window, so he's trying to get everything done that FDR did over a period of many years, you know, in a 2 year period. And he's in danger of overreaching, maybe. I think his infrastructure bill has many good things in it, but it's really expensive. And there are things in it that really have nothing to do with infrastructure. That's too bad, but I understand why he feels that he needs to do it. In terms of what he is saying, as he did in Tulsa and other places, he's really reawakening for people a belief in a good America. As opposed to Trump, a caring America. I think that's great. But he also has to be careful, Walter, about being pushed too far to the left. Because what Republicans don't have a lot to say. They didn't even have a platform in the last presidential election. They don't have a lot to say positive, but they can run against the progressive left. And that's what they're doing. And the more he gets pushed into that orbit, the more it's going to help Republicans politically.
Mickey Edwards, thank you so much for joining the show.
Walter, thanks. It's great to see you.
And finally, we want to take you back to a year that changed the face of music and culture. 1971 gifted us a collection of epic albums from Marvin Gaye, the Rolling Stones, David Bowie, and many, many more. Well, now, a new Apple TV Plus docuseries, 1971, the year that music changed everything, explores what made that year so transformative for music. Take a look at a clip from the trailer.
1971 was a year of revolutionary consciousness.
We were fueled by this amazing music that everyone was making. It was articulating everything you're seeing and feeling.
You know, we have survived everything that's gone down and come out stronger.
The series is co-directed and produced by Danielle Peck, and she joins us now from London. Danielle, I've been looking forward to this conversation. Thank you so much for coming on, and not just because of the music that we're playing, but also just the exchange that you and I are going to have, because a lot of people that grew up with this music that were there in 1971, my question, why 1971? That there was great music in the previous years and the subsequent years as well.
Yeah, it's a really, really good question. And it just seems that 71, it was a magical year. You look at key artists made their masterpieces that year. And then there were breakthrough artists. You know, David Bowie was nobody until 1971, really. He'd had one hit and then had wandered in the wilderness. Elton John. And then it was also a year where more mature artists, you know, Marvin Gaye, the former Beatles, John Lennon, they reinvented themselves. So there's this wonderful confluence of new stars and maturing stars all striving to do something wonderful.
And what role did war and all of the social changes and unrest happening not only in the U.S. but around the world play in making this such a defining year for music?
Massively important. I mean, it wasn't just protest music. You know, there was some really important protest songs, like War Is Over, for example, and, you know, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On in its own fashion was a protest song. But there was also a huge rise in
African-American mainstream music. It was taking their story into the mainstream world. And that was fueled by events like the Attica prison riots and the massacres of the prisoners there in 71. War was important, but it had been going on for a long time, so that wasn't new. But the things that evolved out of that, for example, the war on drugs, you know, there's a lot of GIs coming back from Vietnam who had got hooked on drugs and bringing that back to the States primarily. And that generated a whole kind of culture in the States, and that fueled its own music. So it was a really interesting time for politics to really play out in the cultural field.
How did that evolve, and I would say rather quickly, from the 60s sort of era of free love?
Well, it evolved quite quickly because, you know, think of the Summer of Love. I mean, just a few years later, we're talking about 1971 happening, and the hippie thing was pretty much done and dusted by then. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of our films is called The End of the Acid Dream because that bubble had burst. So, you know, there were quite a lot of burnouts. And some of them were, you know, the musical stars, unfortunately, people like Sly Stone and Jim Morrison. And, you know, they had been the people that had sort of driven through the Summer of Love and the hippie period, and it didn't last. So it transpired that, you know, that negative aspect of the drug scene, the music scene, didn't last long, the positive side. It went negative quite quickly.
And you're right, it really did shine a light on black artists in particular, Aretha Franklin and Marvin Gaye. And yet so many of the, mm-hmm. the issues that came to the forefront at the time that you could feel through their songs viscerally and through the lyrics, whether it's war, injustice, and racism, they permeate today as well. What have you seen as in terms of the evolution over these past 50 years on those subjects?
Well, that was a really, really odd thing. I mean, we started making this series about 3 years ago. I mean, the idea started even earlier than that, about 5 years ago. But as we were making it, and as I started sort of working out how we're going to sort of coordinate all this music and all this material together, these parallels with what was going on, you know, we were still in the Trump presidency at that point, obviously, and Me Too and Black Lives Matter, and all this material seemed to speak of the same subjects 50 years later. I mean, I always think that if Nixon had had Twitter, we wouldn't have been too far off having the equivalent to President Trump then. And it was just really peculiar that all these things started to come together. We hadn't really predicted that, but, you know, because we went in this with our eyes open about the music and the cultural aspect and the political aspect. The parallels were really striking to us. And so in answer to your question, I guess, in a way, things haven't moved on as much as we would like. And that's, you know, that's pretty disappointing.
It is disappointing. And look, it leads to more music and creativity, right? And expressing the times that we are in. Looking back then, also 1971 could be described as the year that sort of gave birth or the inspiration for hip hop, what would later become hip hop as well.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, Gil Scott-Heron and The Last Poets were seminal. And the work they did in 71 that was fueled by the events of 71 were really important. And we're still living that music very much today. And, you know, I think that there is some fantastic work being done. I don't profess to be an expert of modern music now, but I mean, you know, the power of some of the artists out there today, they're still there saying their things. I'm just not sure they're being heard quite so easily because of the way that music is consumed nowadays.
Yeah, you know, it's always interesting because I think it's cliche when you hear an older generation say they don't make music the way they used to. But I have to say, when you watch a documentary and docuseries like yours and you do some of the research that you're doing, it's hard to argue against that. What was the most surprising thing that you've discovered throughout this research?
Oh, goodness, that's a big question to answer. I think that the surprising thing is that 71 was not really talked about before. I mean, ultimately, people think, oh, you know, 68 was a great year, maybe 84, 89 was a great year. 71. Everybody's going, why 71? It was your first question. And I think that's the most surprising thing, is what was it about 71 that made it so magical? And it was just, you know, it's almost like a crystal. It has all these facets. And so lots of surfaces and things will grow from that. And that's kind of what 71 was. Lots of events happening, lots of people getting to certain points in their career. And it was just a perfect storm. And that was the big surprise.
Look, one of the beauties of having these kind of longer conversations is that you learn so much, right? I didn't know much about 1971 music as well until now. I have to ask you before we leave, what was your favorite song, favorite album from that year?
Well, I mean, I rediscovered Hunky Dory. I was too young. I mean, I was born, but I was only a little girl in 71. So I didn't grow up in that wealth of music. But I reconnected with Hunky Dory, and that was a very powerful, you know, David Bowie was a hero, and he very much, you know, there's a quote from him in the film that he, you know, we were inventing the 21st century in 1971, and that's basically, you know, that was Bowie through and through.
Well, he became so legendary after that year. It is a fantastic series. Daniel, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Joining us. Really appreciate it. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online on our podcast and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.